necessarily an event.
Alternative. Chuck O'Shelley.
24th day of August 2017, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is indeed the O'Shelley Effect. Broadcast live from O'Shelley.com, but also heard on, Awake Radio US, AutonomousMedia.net, RealLibertyMedia.com, few other places possibly playing the show simultaneously as we go live. And as I hear somebody's lighter snap, of course, we do welcome you no matter how you're encountering it later on down the stream via your final slab of choice, your applicable application, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, it is a Thor's day night. Yes, it's Thursday. And that does mean that we usually cover sinister history. Now, we're going to take a bit of a break because, you know, I've been in pretty bad mood trying to discuss the current political climate, the craziness that is out there, the strangeness of American culture at the moment. And this is going to be a therapy session for me because we're going Trump free. All right. Anyway, Carmine Sabastano is with me, and hopefully we will be joined later by Larry Hancock. Both of them authors in their own right, but let's talk about Carmine since he's here already. Two Princes and a King, TPAAK, TPAAK.com is the website that not only can you learn about his book, but there are many articles which Carmine has put out there, incredibly informative about historical events of many types, in fact. His book, Two Princes and a King, is about a concise review of three assassinations, which are key in telling us about the trajectory of things to come afterwards. And that, of course, is the two Kennedys, who are the two princes, Bobby and John. And then, of course, the king being Martin Luther King Jr. Those three assassinations being concisely reviewed in Two Princes and a King, which is available on Amazon and all that. But I do stress you should go to TPAAK.com, TPAAK.com. Also, Neapolis Media Group, something else that you need to look at. And I'm sure we'll discuss that more later, but I'm tired of running my mouth, so I'm going to ask Carmine, how you doing tonight, man?
I'm doing okay. Good to be back, Chuck.
Yeah, you know, I took a week off, and it was an interesting week to take off, I got to tell you.
You can never guess, you know. Unfortunately, none of us have a crystal ball, so you don't know what week to pick. What are you going to do? Something was bound to happen anyway, so.
No, absolutely. And like I said, we will attempt to get Larry in shortly because Larry Hancock is another guy. Many, many books he's written. And, you know, gee, I have no idea what Larry would say about current events. But we're going to do two nights with Larry anyway, because tomorrow night we're going to discuss his latest work, Unidentified, which has something to do with UFOs. And I find it fascinating that Larry would even begin to conquer that subject. So we are going to going to have an interesting time of it tomorrow night with Larry for sure. And again, hopefully he'll join us shortly. So what is it that I wanted to bring the three of us together for? And what is it that we're going to do with a lot of the upcoming Thursdays here up until the Lancer conference in November, which I do believe runs the 17th to the 19th or something like that in November. I'm pretty sure that's the dates.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And an interesting array of speakers are going to be there. This is in Dallas at the Adolphus Hotel. They usually do these on a weekend close to the date of the assassination, which, of course, is November 22nd. And, you know, over the years, I've had mixed feelings about a lot of these conferences and get-togethers. I've been to very few of them and participated never in not a single one. However, this year I'm going to. I'm actually going to speak, and if they need people for panels, I'll be available. I don't think I'll be very popular, but I will be available. And if you're in Dallas, you can actually come and see me face to face if you go to the Lancer Conference and Carmine. And believe it or not, Michael Swanson is going to be there with us. Larry Hancock is going to be there with us. Bill Simpich, who has been on this show recently, is going to be there with us, along with a lot of other people. Now, Simpich is not necessarily part of our little clique here, coming onto the show very often. We don't know Bill all that well, or at least I don't. But definitely it's going to be fascinating to get together with these people. Now, why is it that I would choose this year? Well, quite honestly, to me, this is one of the better years to do this. There's not a tremendous amount of hype and looky-loos coming from people that are simply there because it's the 50th anniversary and, hey, it's time to make noise and do your thing for your website so that you can get lots of attention because of it being a seminal anniversary and all that. There's actually going to be there a bunch of people that have done some stellar work over the years. And, of course, you know, there's a mixed bag, as per usual. But there are some incredible highlights this year that are coming up, and I do want to discuss that with you. But where is it, Carmine, that we should start explaining about this? I mean, should we talk about the Lancer Conference and its history, give people a general sort of flavor for it? What do you think?
Sure. Yeah, I wrote down a couple notes about it. The JFK Lancer Conference has been ongoing for 20 years. For over 20 years, I'm sorry. The event brings together researchers, authors, experts, and supporters from across the world for 3 days in November to present research and evidence. The conference additionally provides an opportunity for the public to engage with some of the people who contributed significantly to aspects of the investigation, are outspoken advocates opposing government suppression, or connected directly to the events of President Kennedy's assassination.
No, and there you go. Now, why is it named JFK Lancer? Well, very simple. The Secret Service code name for John F. Kennedy when he was president was Lancer. So this is where the name came from. Of course, Deborah Conway has been the one running it for, I do believe, since its beginning. There used to be a competing conference of sorts, which was the COPA conference. That is now not quite functional as it was. And there are other events that do take place there in Dallas. There's always been a moment of silence, I would say, since the 1970s, I think, is when it was begun by author Penn Jones. Again, we're going to leave commentary on everybody that we bring up here tonight a little light. But the thing is that Penn Jones used to hold a moment of silence on the Grassy Knoll area in the area of the events that took place on November 22nd, 1963, to remind people of what it is they may or may not have lost that day. That has been ongoing for a long time. John Judge actually became one of the people that participated in that after, I believe, Penn Jones started it. But you know what? I might actually need to turn to Larry Hancock to ask him about that. He might know a little better about some of the history of the Lancer Conference itself. And he is finally with us. Larry, how are you?
Hi, how are you, Chuck? Yes, I should have the history. I've been doing it for about 15 years now.
Right. And, you know, full disclosure, you're also what do they call you, the co-chair, or are you the chairman of the board there? I mean, what is your actual title? I know the answer to this question, Larry, but for the audience's sake, go ahead.
I'm the speaker chair. They rely on me to kind of prospect for speakers that may have done new research in the last year or so. The conference is very much research oriented. So I try to monitor what people are doing and posting about on forums and identify folks that may have new things. And then I have a fairly long list of people that I know that don't necessarily go online a lot that I stay in touch with. And so basically my job is to prospect for people that have new research or new information. And then I propose them to a group and we ask for proposals, we review the proposals, and then ultimately I end up working with the speakers and doing the schedules and trying to get everything coordinated from the speaker standpoint.
Right, there you go. And of course, Larry, in his own right, you know, could hold a conference just on the books he's written. There should be like a Larry Hancock conference anyway, I think, coming very soon, because the diverse subject matter that you've covered, and I mentioned it briefly at the beginning of the show, but you'll be back with us again tomorrow night, actually, discussing a topic that I never thought you would get into. Just, you know, for the sake of the audience, here we go again. Unidentified, interesting topic, and, you know, give people the bullet points on that, what we're going to be talking about tomorrow night real quick.
Indeed. And Chuck, you might find this amusing. I have the book is basically another book about the national intelligence community. The first part of the book explores how they responded to unidentified flying objects, the military aspects, the potential threat, all the way from World War II through the Cold War. But then I go on and actually apply some alternative scenario techniques and really use a database of unknowns that the Air Force built and vetted to do my own strategic analysis that nobody ever allowed the intelligence community to do. That's kind of the long and short of the book, but you may find it amusing. I'm familiar with that community. There's a UFO community just as there is a JFK community. And one of the first things I encountered was conservative individuals within the UFO community going, "Who is this person? They write about JFK. We're skeptical." And then on the other hand, I have people going, "Hey, you should stay with JFK because the UFO arena is too skeptical." So I've managed to put my foot into both pools and trip over both feet.
Well, and you know what? Good job on that, because isn't this always the thing that they've thrown at us, right? As JFK researchers, they've always said, "Oh, well, then I bet you believe in little green men and UFOs and the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot." And all of a sudden we're into cryptozoology, we're into ghosts and other things. And I wonder how it is that asking questions about history, which have not been satisfactorily resolved in the public arena, has something to do with all of that. But then again, if you take a look at the national security state and you examine things through that lens, it does kind of make sense that you'd have to examine some of these other issues that might seem trivial to someone who is studying a historical figure. And then again, those historical figures might seem trivial to those that believe that this is an earth-shattering event that is going to change society as a whole. So good job there, actually, being able to weave your way or sew your way, I don't know, thread that needle, if you will, through the two different communities, because I actually don't know too many people that have done that, Larry.
That's because they didn't survive, Chuck. No, just kidding. A little humor.
yeah.
No, they haven't. And certainly from the purely, I know some folks, there are some very good research historians in that community who have approached it as a historical project, have delved deeply into the documents and to the intelligence type research, but you don't hear much of them. They're history oriented. They're not sensationally oriented, and they really don't dwell on most of the standard talk radio shows. They're there, just as we have them in the JFK and the political assassination community. But a lot of times, those people aren't very visible. And I've been in touch with several of them. They've been very helpful, but you know, they kind of keep their heads low.
Yeah, and a good point that you make, that there is a less visible contingent in the JFK research community. As a matter of fact, there's various layers of it that have built up. I mean, you got to understand, when you're looking at something for over half a century, many little subgenres of the subculture will begin to be formed. And it's interesting to me that that you're one of these people who has been universally acceptable to nearly everybody that I've ever encountered anyway. And believe me, I've encountered some of the more fringe elements of people involved in the JFK assassination research community. And a lot of others might say that the only way that this crosses over is when you make the contention that, you know, Kennedy was killed because he was going to reveal the existence of UFOs and all that. But I promise you guys, tomorrow night, we're going to get deeper into the topic of the national security state and unidentified things. Anyway, tonight we're talking about Lancer. And one thing that I said also before you got on the call is that the name of the group is devised from the Secret Service designation, giving John F. Kennedy the code name when he was president, Lancer. I used to know all of the Kennedy family's names that the Secret Service used to identify them by. I do recall quite vividly that Lyric was Caroline Kennedy. I cannot remember what Jackie's was. If somebody said it, I'd probably know it. But it is interesting
go ahead. I can give you that, Chuck, because she had probably one of the most appropriate crypts I've ever heard. There are a couple of others. Her crypt was Lace.
Lace, that's it. There we go. So you had Lancer, Lace, Lyric. Do you know what John Jr.'s was?
I do not.
But look, another area of research, by the way, that you can get into is just studying the Secret Service. And some people are devoted to that. Meanwhile, we're talking about the Lancer Conference, and Carmine gave a very general overview that that it has a long history, a little longer than you've been involved in it, Larry. You know, like you said, 15 years or so, but it did exist. I think it came into existence right after the ASC conferences kind of stopped in Dallas. Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely correct. Deborah Conway felt that something needed to carry on that initiative. And I will say that the conference was really not the starting point. Back in those days, and it's almost hard to imagine now, the goal for Lancer was document research and obtaining documents via FOIA, obtaining documents from the National Archives and publishing them. And at first, they were published in paper collections, and then they were published on CD. I can remember Rex Bradford coming to a Lancer conference and bringing up the entire exciting concept of HTML coding and putting documents as PDFs on the web. And we all went, oh, gosh, that would be like science fiction. And so we could actually look at them online, because up until then, it was all paper. And Deborah's goal was really to set up a company that was a publishing company, but a publishing company for documents and for studies and, quite honestly, for the sort of books about the assassination that were not going to find a home with a major publisher. The conferences were never secondary, but they were only part of it.
Well, right. I mean, I'll note that one of the best volumes ever published, I think it was Lancer who published it. Again, I'm going off of sheer memory here, was William Matson Law's In the Eye of History, I think was published by Lancer, wasn't it?
That is correct. As a matter of fact, I just talked to William about 30 minutes ago. And that came out of, as many of those works did, primary research. Deborah actually organized a meeting with several of the Bethesda personnel who had been at the autopsy, took them to a meeting room, turned on a video camera, and spent hours and hours with she and William interviewing them and doing videotapes of them. And again, in those days, it's about primary research. It still is about primary research. But In the Eye of History was one of the first real exposures of a lot of the disconnects that we have at Bethesda.
Well, it was certainly the first time I ever saw somebody adequately put together a strong overview of witnesses who had firsthand accounts to offer regarding what it is we see today as, in the public's arena. First of all, there is not a complete view of the medical evidence, first of all. Right. And this is a very narrow subject. I understand, people, but you got to understand that this requires a lot of study to even begin to wrap your mind around. And the fact that William Mattson Law had put together this volume is extremely, I don't know, it was one of the most impressive books to me over the years, actually, and is one of those things that I see as a prime reference for somebody who is trying to delve deeply into the subject if you want to understand what's happening. It's not the only one, but it's definitely packed with a lot of information that you're not going to get in one place. And this is the thing, right? When people were talking about putting together the Mary Farrell Foundation, website and all of this, it was about scanning, first of all, if I remember correctly, it was about scanning Mary's archives into an accessible format on the internet, which a lot of people scoffed at. And it actually took somebody to come along and finance that when Mary was quite honestly about ready to leave the planet. That's about the time that came into being. And this has become an integral and indispensable research tool for a lot of people over the years as well. But again, we're talking about Lancer tonight. But these things have all sort of evolved together hand in hand, haven't they, Larry?
They have, and very much hand in hand. Again, as I mentioned, Rex really came forward with discussions at Lancer conferences about how we could use the new technologies. Then, as you said, the opportunity came up, and I was at the initial meeting that brainstormed a lot of the things that went on to form the Mary Farrell Foundation and to do the scanning and the document placement. And then the Mary Farrell Foundation reached out to the ARC and to other sources and brought in tremendous bodies of documents beyond Mary's collection. So I think a lot of people take all this for granted, and I can understand that, but this has been a very evolutionary process and is somewhat unique. You know, having researched other areas, there are not collections like this on other subjects of Cold War history that are available. It is unique, and I think we take it for granted. When I wander off into other subjects, there's no resource like the Mary Farrell Foundation.
No, absolutely. And I also note that one of the things that was utterly essential to me was the Assassination Records archive page as well. Early on, I mean, this was, you know, I could get a hold of the Rockefeller papers. I could get a hold of all of the Warren Commission without actually having to, own the 26 volumes, which was a difficult thing to be able to purchase or get your hands on. Quite honestly, I never owned a physical copy of it myself, but I was able to get one on CD very early on when actually it came on a couple of CDs, because at first they couldn't be put onto one CD. But, you know, over time, data has become a lot more manageable. And now I'm sure you can carry something on your keychain that'll hold all the information you need without an issue. But there was a time when you needed to stack a spindle of CDs in order to go through all this stuff. And it is interesting to note just that evolution. And I wanted to, take a step back and remember that, you know, this came from a lot of different places. And over the years, the Lancer Conference has even evolved. There's been a lot of interesting people that have participated in it and have contributed to it. Before we start talking about the 2017 conference, I think Carmine has a few notes on some of the people that have been part of it before. Right, Carmine?
Yeah. Some of the past speakers and presenters include forensic expert Sherry Feaster, president of the Mary Farrell Foundation and case expert Rex Bradford, author and professor Joan Mellon, author Gail Nix Jackson, who has pursued the return of her family-seized film of the Kennedy assassination for decades, researcher Joseph Bax, Kennedy family member and historian Kathleen McCarthy, Kennedy family member and public servant Kevin M. McCarthy, author James Douglas, who wrote the acclaimed JFK and the Unspeakable, author Jerry Dealey, the great-grandnephew of George Bannerman Dealey, who the plaza is named after, Jacob Carter, the author of Before History Dies, a book that interviews notable researchers from both sides of the case, former FBI Special Agent James Hostie, House Select Committee on Assassination staff member Gaten Fonzie, author and historian Peter Dale Scott, and medical expert and researcher Dr. Cyril Wecht.
Well, absolutely, and among others, because, look, we couldn't even list everybody.
Well, yeah, there's actually, also this year's, too. That's a whole nother list.
Oh, yeah.
I figured Larry didn't want to be in both, so I put him in the this year's list.
Well, right. Well, hang on, because we'll get to Larry, believe me. But the thing is that you also had people like Donald Thomas, who participated in the acoustical evidence in a way that nobody else ever did. I'm very sure that he did a presentation there. There are many, many others who were witnesses for one reason or another, who have been a part of the fabric of the discussion over the years for one reason or another, not just authors, in fact, but, you know, really remarkable that that you know, former Agent Hostie was there. This year, there's an interesting witness to the assassination or the assassination, and also the creator of one of the most unique historical documents in the assassination, in my estimation, on this year's list of speakers. You know, and then again, there was a whole lot of other people that came together. Also, James Douglas alone is one of these people that that I really, you know, am impressed by. Anytime I've spoken with him, even privately, I was impressed by his careful and thoughtful nature about the way that he approached this subject and many others. So, you know, you're talking about some of the most responsible people, some of the very best speakers, some of the most unique people have come together at the JFK Lancer conferences. Now, this sounds strange to somebody who knew me, say, 10 years ago or 12 years ago, because, you know, quite honestly, I did not want to participate in any of this. There was a reason for it. There was a lot of strife, struggle, let's just say, between little factions that arose. And I'm noticing that a lot of that seems to be going away. And I'm very happy about that. Of course, you know, you put three JFK researchers in a room, give us a couple hours, we'll find stuff to fight about. But, you know, the reality is that there used to be this factionalization, which I think is beginning to shift away. There is, you know, just an adherence to wanting to actually accomplish something. And this year is an interesting grouping. Now, we've given a historical overview. We've given some examples of the people that have been there. Of course, 2017 is an interesting year, given that we have a great document release, which has already begun and is supposed to culminate in, you know, some of the final releases coming around in October, that which is not still withheld in full anyway, et cetera, et cetera. And I noticed that this is a feature of this year's conference, Larry. What do we have to say about that and about the difference here? You know, again, this is not one of those seminal anniversaries like the 50th or like the 25th was or like the 30th anniversary or et cetera, where quite honestly, you get a lot of extra traffic from people that are looking to use this for their own advantage, more or less. And not necessarily, I got to be honest with you, that's what I saw every single time there was a significant anniversary, is a lot of people that were more about being opportunists and wanting to sell their books. I'm finding that on the off years like this one, you'll get a lot more people that, yeah, of course, selling your book is maybe part of the reason why you go and participate, or selling your brand is part of the reason why you participate. But quite honestly, it seems to me like on the off years, there's more of a focus on adding something to the conversation, on getting something done, on being productive and getting out the better information. Now, I know that sounds like a harsh criticism, Larry, but what do you think of it?
No, wearing my recruiting hat, I will say it's absolutely true. It's much easier for me to get people on an anniversary year. The 50th was easy. I had to turn people away. People contact me on other years, I have to go out and contact them. So that phenomena absolutely exists. I think one of the things that we've done to kind of minimize it, and this has been a learning process. The conference has changed quite a bit over the years. Now we kind of, we run different phases of, if you want to come and talk about your book and you don't have any new research, we'll give you an author's table and people can come and talk to you because they like to do that. But if you don't have any new research, you're not necessarily a speaker. So that minimizes a bit of the effect that you're talking about. The other thing is that we've always tried to put in an element of JFK history. So we invite other types of people. Last year we had the Newmans interviewed, but we've had JFK historians. We've had JFK collectors. We've had Cold War figures, congressmen off intelligence panels. But one of the most interesting, just an anecdote, you go, well, JFK collectors, why would you want to do that? Well, one of the most interesting sessions I ever heard was when a JFK collector turned up with some tapes that he had purchased from Sturgis family. And these were fascinating tapes because they recorded phone calls between Sturgis and his lawyer. And they gave you a real insight into where Sturgis was really coming from and had been coming from. And you will never hear that anyplace else than at the conference at that one time. Collectors mm-hmm. do come up with some very interesting things. So for your overall question, definitely that's true, but we've been, tried to be a little bit more creative. There are always some presentations that are designed for newcomers and aren't brand new research. They literally are tutorials or introductory overview type things. So we've mixed it up a bit, and that helps us get through the off years when there's not a line at the door wanting to talk.
Hmm. Well, you know, with that, I think I'd like to sort of turn to who it is you have assembled this year so far, and there may be other additions coming, right?
There is, although in all honesty, the schedule is pretty tight at this point in time. We're down to doing the final schedule and seeing really whether we have a slot open or not. It's, I think, because it is a document release year, there was a lot of anticipation of this at last year's conference. I'm kind of puzzled by the fact that there are still people maintaining that somehow this is the end of the whole cycle and everything that was secret is going to be disclosed. I mean, there are people still maintaining that and people expecting it. But because it's the end of a cycle and because of our context, kind of the heart of the conference this year is going to be on the document releases. And we have Dr. Newman, we have Jeff Morley, we have Malcolm Blunt coming over from the UK, who's always been a premier insider researcher at NARA, Bill Simpich. We have folks that have, you know, these are people that know the crypts. These are people that can read the documents. These are people that can put things in context. And each of those are going to be speaking to what they found, what they think is significant. And that'll be the core of the conference this year in regard to document studies.
Right. A random question arises from the chat room, which I think could actually provoke an interesting conversation here. Somebody says that they heard that Jackie's dress has been tucked away for 100 years. There are various pieces of physical evidence in the case that are designed to never be seen by the public or to be seen by the public at a later date. There's various taped interviews that are supposed to be withheld for certain amounts of time. There's always stuff like this that that people point to when they discuss the case. You know anything about the dress, though, Larry? Because I'm actually at a loss here to know about exactly what the deal is with the dress, except that it might fall under the very same rubric that his shirt and tie does and everything else at the National Archives. I don't know. But you know anything about Jackie's dress from that day?
I, I do not know specifically about the dress. I wish I did. I know articles of clothing are held by the archives. I also know that those items that are held by the archives that were actually property of the Kennedy family, and that extends beyond the clothing to elements of the medical evidence, physical evidence relating to the autopsy, are under control of the Kennedy family lawyers. And even though they are at the archives, they are totally different and protected in a different fashion than the documents are. And you can only get access to those through individual permission.
Yeah, I think the phrase that is used is a deed of gift, which it is then placed into the archives' possession for. However, access to these things is still strictly vetted by the holders of the deed. This is why the Kennedy lawyers, even though Jackie has passed away, and most of the people that probably initiated that entire thing, you know, it probably falls under the control of, well, Caroline Kennedy, I guess, right?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I just wanted to interject. I pulled up an article on this, and it says Caroline Kennedy gave the suit as a gift to the people of the United States with the understanding it would not be put on display until 2103.
Well, there you go. Okay, so that's exactly where we're at. And it kind of makes sense. You know, we are confronted today by you can go and see the chair that President Lincoln was sitting in when he was assassinated. Or at least you used to be able to. Don't know if you can today, but there was a point at which you could do that. And it is kind of, I don't know. You know, it's one of those things that's strange. I don't know what the significance of it would be. I don't think very much blood spatter evidence could be garnered off of Jackie's dress or anything like that, because it was not immediately captured and preserved, so on and so forth. Of course, the late Sherry Feaster would have explained that to us much better. But, you know, and by the way, that's somebody that I really wish I was able to meet at the conference this year. I just want to make that personal note. I'm very saddened by her departure. Anyway, back to Chuck, this.
If I could make one more comment along those lines, and this is part observation and part information. We will have a presenter this year, Ralph Robertson, who is a medical professional and who did manage to gain access to certain of the medical evidence. He obtained a release through the legal process that you were talking about, and will be reporting on some of his findings, which are totally new. One of the things that we have learned kind of the hard way is there is a sensitivity about this. If it tends to be that if you are a professional and you have the right credentials, they may allow you to see something once. The interesting thing is you hardly ever get to see it twice.
Right.
And I'll just let that lay for whatever it might suggest. But we do have some brand new information in regard to some medical material in that collection that he will be presenting for the first time, period.
Right. Well, you know, with that, let's go over the complete list as it stands of speakers really quickly. We have Russ Baker, who is the author of Family of Secrets, also guy behind a particular website. I believe it's called Who What and How or something like that. But Russ Baker, you can look him up, Family of Secrets. Malcolm Blunt, who you already mentioned from the UK, very interesting guy, somebody who comes up in conversation privately with Joan Mellon constantly. And, of course, Joan is one of those people that's a favorite of mine. She won't be there this year. However, Alan Dale, who has been on this show and is also an extremely responsible and interesting speaker on the subject, will also be speaking. Brian Edwards, I'm not extremely familiar with, and I'm literally reading down the list. Chris Gallup, you know, who... Go ahead.
Brian and Chris are both address what I mentioned earlier. Both of them, one is a law enforcement professional, the other is a career teacher, and they do overview presentations on... The one will be doing an overview of issues from the Bethesda autopsy. They tend to we have them present, and they're very good to do it every year, to come up, build a different presentation, which is largely intended for newcomers to the conference. And I will say, our newcomers and newcomers to the study of the assassination probably comprise at least half of the attendees. So Brian and Casey and Chris serve to help those folks.
Absolutely. And then here's another guy I never heard of, Larry Hancock. Anyway.
That's for comedy. I do the comedy relief.
It's okay. But listen, Larry Hancock, if you don't know who he is and you're listening to this show, I don't know how you got here. Anyway, we'll move forward and discuss other people because we discuss Larry a lot. David Josephs is an interesting guy. How did he get involved here, Larry?
This is Deborah gives me the option every year to invite one or two people at my discretion that I think have something really different. It may be really controversial. It may be a little bit out of the mainstream. David has done a tremendous amount of research on the purported Mexico City trip of Lee Oswald and has prepared a very contrarian study along the fact that what is in evidence showing that he was there is highly questionable. And we do try to offer a couple of those every year, but David is solid. Everything goes to actual documents, to primary evidence. And so that's pretty much mine in this case. It's like, okay, David, here's a shot. Let's put it up and see how it goes.
Right. Okay. Andrew Krieg is an interesting person as well, Larry.
Yeah, Andrew comes to us from Kappa. And you mentioned this earlier, and we have, in recent years, we've been able to establish much more of a working relationship with the ARC, with Kappa, with the other groups. Andrew, again, very familiar with the subject of JFK, but he is going to be talking about some of the broader issues relating to JFK research, as someone else on the list named Chuck will be. And we do like to broaden our spectrum and address how this whole thing works, not just individual research presentations, but how this body of studies is carried out. And, you know, what are the pitfalls and what are the successes? And Andrew would be doing that strictly. Actually, we're looking at a panel that will go into a certain amount of Cold War history in regard to JFK. And Andrew and myself and John Newman plan to appear on a panel that will discuss JFK as a Cold Warrior, hawk or dove.
Which is one of those debates that continues on and on, quite honestly, even with the concept that was offered. In JFK and the Unspeakable, of course, we mentioned James Douglas earlier. But, the idea, was he turning from something to something else? Had he already been there? I'm one of these guys who believes that, you know, he was just like anybody else. It wasn't so clear cut black and white, and that he had a concept of what the Third World was like. And he had a concept of what the reality was behind the Cold War, but also had to play the game at the same time. And in some ways was a true believer as well. It's not necessarily black and white. There's many a gray area, you know, in my estimation, and definitely an interesting topic. Now, this next gentleman is, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, but, you know, I was reading about him, and he's got something to do with the Rose Sheremy case. And the Rose Sheremy case, well, here we go. Let's point to the JFK movie, because I know that's accessible to people who may not be entirely familiar with all the documentation. If you remember, there was a woman who was sort of dismissed out there on a roadside somewhere and is making claims about Kennedy being assassinated before he was in that movie. I'm not talking about the reality here, guys. I don't want to get into the discussion, but it was depicted in the JFK movie in that way. And I think it was the same woman who played Hot Lips in the original MASH or something that was actually the actress who portrayed her. But he's got some interesting links to the Rose Jeremy of real life, doesn't he?
Well, he does, especially because she was his mother.
There you go.
and he is the child that is mentioned in her statements to the police. He is the child that was mentioned in conjunction with why she was making this trip and the kind of leverage that was being held over her. Michael is, again, Lancer helped Michael to actually put together and publish his book on his mother. It's not a JFK research. It's a historical book on his mother and resolves a lot of the mysteries. A lot of things that we deal with at the conference, in other words, if you just look at the JFK literature, you don't get the full context. You need to understand some of these people and their lives. And that's what that book was about, and that's what Michael addressed. But just in terms of the conference and this subject, over the years, we have had the actual secretary who worked with Frugier, the Louisiana police officer who transported Rose Jeremy. We had her come to the conference. We have worked with some of the folks that did the very earliest research with Frugier, with his story, talked to the doctors. So this is a story that we have pursued over the years. Michael is part of it, but it's hard to explain how the continuity of the conference has elaborated on some of these stories in a way that you just don't pick up reading one, post or reading something on the internet, because we've given people the opportunity to get to the sources at which is no longer possible. It was possible 10 years ago, 15 years ago. In many cases, it's just not possible. The good news is almost all of that was captured on the DVDs of the conferences. So those are available too. But yes, Michael, last year, one of the things, and I'll elaborate just a little bit, Michael's story allowed us to pursue a little bit further into where his mother actually heard this story. And as it turns out, this story is a little bit different than we thought at first. And it actually originated from the two people that were transporting her, but the story originated in Dallas. And it becomes very interesting because it allows us to trace the whole thing back to a leak from Jack Ruby.
Right. And, again, what I'm trying to present here while I go through this list is that you're not going to sit here and be treated to here's Dealey Plaza. Here's where Lee Harvey Oswald may or may not have been. And here's the car. You know, a lot of people think that that's all it's going to be for a whole weekend. And I want to explain to them that there's a great many aspects here that are being explored in various ways and with various individuals' assistance and with assisting various individuals to tell their personal stories, which brings me to the next presenter here, which is Marianne Moorman Kramer. Okay, Marianne Moorman, here I happen to know that a book is being assembled on her at this moment. And she is fascinating because guess what? You've seen her work. If you've ever looked at just about anything that's associated to the John F. Kennedy assassination that has a visual aspect to it, the Polaroid photograph. Okay, the only Polaroid photograph that I know of that actually captures the limousine right just well, according to some estimates, about 1/6 of a second after the fatal headshot landed. Okay. You've seen this photograph over and over again. This is the woman who took it, who accidentally, in my estimation, becomes a historical journalist and on the ground journalist that day without ever intending to do so for one of the most controversial historical events in history. And her photograph has been utilized and examined by people who have discussed everything from Badge Man, onto the Grassy Knoll examinations, onto the arguments about who was standing where, and it's even referenced when people start arguing about the Zapruder film, because, well, quite honestly, I think she captured Abraham Zapruder in her photograph, didn't she? You know, here we go. And just coincidentally, that also makes her a witness to the assassination, in case you weren't keeping score at home. So there you go, Marianne Moorman. Did I give her a fair enough treatment, Larry?
Oh, you absolutely did. And she's, I will say, she's in the tradition of, for a couple of years, we had Buell Frazier, who was obviously a witness of a different sort. We had, as you mentioned earlier, FBI agent Hostie. We've had the Newmans. We had a few years ago, a lady who, as a young girl, was, she's the, you may remember, she's the young girl that's discussed in a lot of the running across the grassy side of the street, and her motions have been analyzed in depth on the internet, but we actually had her down, and she gave the firsthand view of her stories. And I will say, the firsthand discussion that you get from these folks is simply invaluable. And I think it's the reason we've been able to do that, quite frankly. A lot of these people have been very hesitant to come talk at a JFK conference because, quite frankly, many of them have been badly badgered by so-called JFK researchers. They've been harassed with multiple phone calls, and they're very sensitive, as you can imagine. And it's taken a long time to convince many of them to come down and talk to us in person. And we only do that by guaranteeing that there will be absolutely no harassment, or we'll pitch somebody out in the street, which we do.
Oh, no, absolutely. Look, and you know, I know that not to speak out of school here, but I know that Marianne Moorman is one of these people who certainly does not want to be harassed. You know, regardless of what your theory is, what your position is, or whatever, you know, none of these people that are firsthand witnesses to any of this, you know, should suffer harassment from anybody. And I always state that. I mean, I have always politely asked people if they want to speak to me. And if they don't, you know, generally speaking, I don't pursue it very much. And that's the way I've always handled it. But some people are not quite as courteous. And, you know, look, I'll personally assist people being pitched out into the street if need be, if that's what it comes down to, because I'm not putting up with this crap either. You can harass me. I'll deal with that. But a lot of these people have had enough already and, you know, definitely don't need anybody to add into it. So. But Marianne Moorman is an interesting figure for a lot of reasons. And I do like how you bring up the little girl that was, you know, discussed there, because she's the one that, just for the listener's edification, was running alongside of the motorcade path, let's just say. And, you know, she's often noted, why did she stop when this happened? Why was she in motion here? Did she hear a shot? All of these different speculations over the years. And you guys actually had her there and talked about what it was that she saw and heard and everything else, to the best of her recollection. And she would be the one to tell you probably why she stopped running. Anyway, you know, just a thought, folks. Moving on down the list, there's Jefferson Morley, who's been on this show before, and I especially appreciate Jeff because he continuously has sued the CIA to try and get information from them. And, you know, that's a winner in my book anyway, regardless of how much success he's enjoyed with it or not. He has not let it go. And I really appreciate him for that over the years. Journalist in his own right and everything else. I mean, the JFK facts website, I think, is his. And he's definitely an interesting guy all by himself. Written a couple of books, too, by the way. The next guy I am not entirely familiar with, although I've heard about his story before. And this is the Canadian that was the first to purchase a set of the 26 original Warren Commission volumes, according to the bio posted here. at the Lancer Conference website. Anything you want to add about Gary? I guess the last name would be pronounced Murr.
Yes. Gary is a gem, and Gary typifies one of the things I said earlier. There are a lot of what I call very deep researchers that don't really go online much. They've never had time. In all honesty, a really good researcher has a limited amount of time, and Gary is one of those people. I mean, I happen to be a document researcher, and I've done some other primary research, but Gary is one of those people that goes places that no one else goes. If he's researching the Carcano ammunition, he goes to the people that made the bullets. He goes to the armories that stored the bullets. He goes to the weapon sales firms that sold the bullets around. And he works outside the normal document trail. And if he's investigating the Connolly wounding and the bullets fragments that are related to that, he goes to a different set of people. So Gary is unique in that he has gone to people and sources that none of the rest of us have gone to. And
right. And look, Larry, we're gonna continue the discussion in the next hour, because there's still more people on this list, and I want to give people a grand overview of this. We'll even continue to talk about Gary's work, because I do know a little bit about some of the stuff he's done, and I want to talk a little bit about it. So in the next hour, we'll continue discussing the JFK Lancer Conference here on the Ocelli Effect. Stay tuned, guys. Larry Hancock and Carmine Sabastano are with me, and it's going to get more interesting.
Windows. I use organic web design for all my website, hosting, and digital design needs. High quality work, reliable and competitive. Go to organicwebdesign.eu and contact Tony for a free quote.
Reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Okay, can we get quiet, please? Everybody sit down. Young man in the front row, spit that gum out. Thank you. Cherry flavored. And now, the moment we've been waiting for. The man whom we all know and have grown to love over the years. Who won the Nobel Peace Prize for making the largest flavored Jell-O shooter that the world has ever seen. And a great man of science who proved to us once and for all that no matter how much cherry-flavored Jell-O you put in your swimming pool, you still can't walk on water. I give to you, Chuck O'Shelly! Yeah!
So the second hour of the O'Shelly Effect begins here on O'Shelly.com. Of course, we are broadcast on a couple of other networks, and we do appreciate you wherever you're picking up on this. It may be further on down the stream. And if YouTube allows it, I'll put it up there. We'll have to see, because they're getting pretty restrictive with people like me. But we shall see what happens. I will do my best to put it up there. What we're talking about tonight is the JFK Lancer Conference, which is coming up in November. And I do want to say this, Larry, and I'm going to just, you know, do this publicly. Larry Hancock is with me, by the way, who is recognized as the co-chair of the Lancer Conference. And, you know, Carmine Sabastano is with us as well. He will be presenting this year. I didn't get to him on the list yet, but I'm reading through the list of presenters and talking a little bit about what the conference does and all of that. Why? Because there are so many different areas of study, and the JFK Lancer Conference, in my estimation, this year certainly represents a wide variety of areas that that there have been a great many accomplishments in, and quite frankly, there is also a representation of things that require a lot more work by a lot more people, despite the valiant efforts of some of those who have made some extremely great progress. Anyway, on to it, Larry. I will say this. I hope that that I'll be able to get a hold of more of the presenters in advance of the conference for the Thursday night shows, because I want to really spotlight them, and I want to really try and get behind this as much as possible, not just because I'm participating this year, but and also not just because my good friend Carmine is participating in it again this year, but simply because I think this is really something that is going to be part of what's going to make progress in the next few years as we contend with the document release this year, as we contend with maybe not one of those great, you know, big anniversary years, 30, 40, 50, 25 as it was, all of that. I think it's going to be time to get some real work done and bring people together to come up with some solutions, some answers, and some real context to one of the historical events that I feel personally is most significant in modern American and world history. So here we go with that discussion just a little more. And I, like I said, Larry, I really hope that you guys let me get a hold of some more people to bring on. We had Bill Simpich recently, who we didn't get to on the list yet either. But we were discussing Gary Murr before. And how could we give people an idea of what the difference is between like a guy like Gary who studies, well, really things that he has to assemble for himself in a way that he decides, look, I'm going to take a look at how you gave an example about bullets. But I mean, Gary's done work on a couple of different things where he has really gone through and decided to see, OK, here's your retailers, here's the wholesalers, here's who could have shipped it, and then actually gone through the trouble to assemble the records, OK, that are not there at the National Archives, that are not there online until somebody like him really puts them together and discovers them for himself, and really has actually handed over a lot of work to people without ever being noted almost anywhere. Larry, what about that?
Yeah, I think one example of what he does, which I would describe it as obsessive research because of the detail that he goes into. We've all talked about an FBI memo that was written shortly after the assassination that talks about the fact that the Carcano bullets in question might have been from a source that actually involved bullets that were covertly manufactured and supplied to the CIA. I suspect both you and Carmine have heard that story, and that's been a just kind of a traditional thing in JFK discussions for ages. Well,
right.
Gary was not satisfied with that. Gary traced the entire path of manufacturing, production of those bullets, the marking system that they used, He obtained essentially the purchase orders and the receipts and the specification sheets for all of that, and essentially demonstrated that the guy who wrote the FBI memo just didn't know what he was talking about. It was written quickly. It was largely speculative, and it is incorrect. Now, it's easy for me to say that. It took Gary approximately 10 years to do that. And that's the way he works.
Right.
You will not get a snap judgment from Gary.
Right. And I mean, think about that. 10 years to track down exactly what the reality is regarding the manufacture of bullets. I mean, again, but essential to having people understand things like, OK, when we turn around and we look at the bullet lead analysis that was conducted by certain individuals. OK. They didn't go to the trouble to know this, did they?
No, they did not. And and that's one of the – they just took a lot of – they didn't really – and we talked about this before. They were simply collecting statements from people, such as that FBI report, and it was enough for them to collect them and put them in the file. It's not like they pursued them, questioned them, challenged them, asked for verification or validation. And this is just one minor example of what happens when you don't do that. The historical record is left with misinformation.
Absolutely. So we're going to move away from Gary because interesting guy. We've already spotlighted him, and you want to learn more, look him up, and also, hey, go to the conference. Next thing is, and I know that this is a personal favorite of mine on the list, and I'm sure that that Carmine's going to have something to say here, because now we come to John Newman. And John, in my estimation, is, you know, no offense to anybody on the call here tonight or anybody who might be listening, but John is absolutely one of the go-to guys when it comes to documentation. I mean, there is I do not question a lot of what John comes up with, and usually it's because he presents to you the documentation, explains to you how it fits together, is exactly the guy who has really revealed a lot of interesting things in the official records that that no one else ever has. And in fact, the concept that there was a need to understand that there might have been a change regarding what was going to happen in Vietnam and everything else came from the original work of John Newman, in my mind. Okay. You know, and here we go. Carmine, well, you know, John Newman as a speaker, what do you think?
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing him and looking forward to meeting him. I know a lot of people respect him, and yeah, he's definitely made a lot of important contributions. I didn't really come across his name until I really started getting into the cryptonyms, because, you know, I don't read books. I've read a few that you and a few other people I trust recommended to me, but I'm usually hip deep in the documents.
Well, right, and you gotta recognize that Newman is exactly that guy too, who is hip deep in the documents, but he's also a military historian, you know, retired retired, yeah, exactly. Well, U.S. Army intelligence officer. And all of that, but also
he was an assistant in the NSA as well.
Well, you know what? Actually, Larry was he also?
He worked in the NSA as well. And I think just my view of what John gives you is John is kind of like Gary Muir. He will spend an agonizing amount of time on details. He doesn't look at just what's in a document. He looks at how it was routed. He performs a flow chart of the routing, who signed off on it, who has the authority. Basically, he looks at what is happening from inside the organization. And a lot of the mistakes that we've made in the past in regard to this subject is to think that we understand the Central Intelligence Agency or the NSA from the outside. And you can't do that because they took great pains to make sure you couldn't do that. Well, not to make sure we couldn't do that, to make sure that the Russians couldn't do that. Mm. And the advance that we've made is with these documents, we can now look at it from the inside, and that is what John does. And that brings you a whole new perspective. It really guts a lot of the stuff that was written about the agency and about historical events like both Cuba and Vietnam in the first few decades, because this is kind of like looking at Foreign Service documents from inside the State Department. Mm-hmm. You can write all you want about what our government policies have been, but until you see those internal documents, you don't know what they really were. Because there's always the public story and the internal story.
Well, the other interesting thing is that John is the first guy to show me personally through his presentations. And it wasn't a personal presentation. I watched as an audience member to understand exactly how these documents are handled. See, that was the thing. I never understood how they were handled very well until John Newman did presentations on it and explained, you know, listen, this is this person signing and taking possession of it. This person had access to it. We don't know who this individual is. They would have to be from this department, so on and so forth. I mean, he really actually shows us how the paperwork used to function even. And nobody else, in my estimation, has done that adequately for the general public except John Newman. You know, that's my view, Larry.
The only person that really comes close to what John is doing is Malcolm Blunt has done something of the same thing, specifically within the Office of Security of the CIA, which is an area that most of us have ignored. You know, we've been interested in JM Wave and the Miami stations and anti-Cuban operations. But more and more, we have learned that, you know, there are pictures within pictures. The Office of Security, the Counterintelligence Group, it's sort of like Mexico City, not to go too far afield, but once you realize that there were competing elements within the Central Intelligence Agency, and there might have been two or three competing groups running their own agendas in the same place with some of the same people, some of the same people knowing the other agendas. I think we tend to think of the CIA or the national security apparatus as kind of a unified body, so we can, blame it for everything or use it to explain everything. And John and Malcolm and a couple of others like Bill Simpich has shown us, no, they never worked that way, and most likely they still don't.
No, I understand that there are others who have done some good work too, but it's just, to me, John is the guy that really laid it out for me in presentations that he's done in the past. Let's move on, because we do have more people on this list. There's me. Okay.
Why are you there? There must have been a reason. I know.
Yeah, there's probably a reason there, and I generally I have a presentation that I think has never been approached at a conference before, in part anyway. Part of it is going to be about my personal description of why this is important still, but also moving forward, I think that there is a great deal of missed opportunity and a great deal of mishandled opportunity to get the rest of the public more involved than we already have regarding getting some answers, getting some work done. The applied pressure from things like the Stone film show us that if you do have a force multiplier, sometimes you can achieve some interesting things. The entire JFK Records Collection Act, you could say, begins with Jim Garrison, ends with Oliver Stone, and then it came to the public reaction to these two things. I could criticize Jim Garrison, I could criticize Oliver Stone, but what I cannot deny is the fact that the public display of these things allowed us to get at a hell of a lot more information than we had before these things were brought to the public's attention. So there you go. That's a very basic idea of what it is I'm going to discuss. Of course, Larry knows better, but we can move on to other people, because here's an interesting guy to me, Casey Quinlan. Now, Casey, for me, again, is very notable because he brought he was one of the guys behind this book I got some years ago, which for the first time was a written account from Ed Hoffman. Now, Ed Hoffman is the guy that was pointed out, saying things like The Men Who Killed Kennedy and a few other places, not very many, but a few other places, as the, not being rude here, but the deaf mute who had a story to offer, but for many, many years had been ignored, and they went to the trouble to create this book. And, if memory serves me, I think Lancer had something to do with that as well, Larry, didn't they?
Yes, Deborah and Lancer helped them publish their book. Again, generally speaking, Lancer has published or gotten published what I would call primary research books that a more mainstream publisher, and especially before there was self-publishing, you just weren't going to get a book like Brian and Casey's out that was so targeted with such a small demographic readership. And that's Lancer enabled that. And that's why you'll find a special collection of books from them that you're just not going to find. You'll find it in bookstores. You may not even find it online because the community is interested in it, but that's it. And so that was always one of Lancer's goals. And yeah, Brian and Casey did that work. And Brian and Casey have gone on to do some other special interviews. And that's why they end up being our educators, basically, is they have that experience in doing interviews and converting it, as you see in that book, to something that people can understand. Because understanding Ed's story especially having him been a deaf mute. I've had conversations with Ed. That was not easy. It takes a lot of skill to develop that story in an explainable fashion when your source has to sign with you.
Well, not only that, but Ed didn't use what we would generally refer to as typical sign language either, in a strict sense. a lot of people don't know this. So this took a particular type of interpretation to even begin to assemble his story in the smallest of ways. So, see, here we go again. Somebody who's got to step outside of their field of expertise, even, or their vocation in some cases, to get at information, because, you know, Ed had a story to tell, but if you couldn't understand it, you were never going to have it told to you. Now, Ed did presentations over the years, you know, with slideshows and a few things. He's since passed away, if memory serves. And, you know, now what we're left with is some of the recordings of those things, some brief film clips, and quite honestly, this volume that that these two gentlemen and I think his daughter also helped to assemble as well.
And his pastor.
That's right. That's right. I didn't remember that, Larry. But look, what I'm saying here, though, is that each one of these individuals that we're talking about as we go down the list, as far as I'm concerned, is easily worthy of a couple hours worth of discussion. I'm just trying to give the bullet points here. Right. And, you know, stepping outside of your vocation is one thing. But how about when your vocation applies directly to what it is you're focused on? Randolph H. Robertson, M.D. Now, this is somebody who you were talking about earlier, and you know, here we go. I mean, he's board certified by the American Board of Radiology, you know, and he has had access to that medical evidence, which is under the deed of gift that we were talking about at the National Archives, one of the things, not the only thing, under the deed of gift and under the control of the Kennedy family. And like you said, had to go to the lawyers and go through a process to be vetted, to be allowed to view the evidence itself, which quite honestly, only a handful of individuals have really been able to examine it. And most of them doctors, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, of course, we all saw the NOVA program. I think that was some 30 years ago almost now. You know, the PBS program where the Dallas doctors were allowed to look at the autopsy photographs and this kind of thing. But I think people don't necessarily appreciate how limited the access to it is. We have some images which have been released and have made their rounds on the internet, et cetera, via the Fox set of autopsy photographs and a few other things that have gotten out. But in reality, the totality of the collection has only been viewed by a select number of individuals who've been able to go through that process. And Randolph Robertson is one of them. Right, Larry?
He is, and I would say without saying too much more and disclosing it, his presentation has the potential of being one of the most explosive presentations at this conference and possibly all conferences.
Well, there you go. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm definitely not going to miss his presentation. And we'll leave that there. The next guy on the list is, he's got an Italian name, Carmine Sabastano. Carmine, you want to give us some hints about what it is, not necessarily disclosing all of what it is you want to talk about this year at the Lancer Conference? Of course, you were there last year. You know, give us an overview. The audience would be familiar with you. But what is it that you're going to be adding to the discussion?
Well, I'm going to be doing more myths this year, debunking myths. I'm going to be offering evidence why I contend that there are some very popular, but unfortunately not very proven ideas that have hung around far beyond any point of usefulness in the case. And I'm going to attempt to help clear the table and then offer a possible new suspect, at the very least someone who has newly been identified in the evidence in my research. And I'm going to discuss that with everyone. And, well, one of the big myths, you know, for those who listen to this show, when we were discussing John Henry Hill, one of the big myths that officials have always had over the years is that there was absolutely no one besides Lee Harvey Oswald with a motive, means, and opportunity to do the crime. And I'm going to debunk that one this year as one of the five.
Excellent. Of course, we have a thing for getting at the myths, you and yeah, I. And
our specialty.
That's one of those things that we do all the time, despite the interesting criticism and the recent allegations that I'm somehow a CIA agent because I do this. I don't know if you've been keeping track of the stuff on Google Plus, but yeah, I'm supposed to be some kind of CIA paid asset now.
Oh, I'm because, sure we've all been called that at one point or another.
Oh, yeah, because I refuse to, embrace things that I say have no evidentiary basis. And again, I'm a little more flexible than you are on some of these subjects. But, nothing is still nothing. OK, 0 + 0 still equals zero. And, lots of speculation, no matter how exciting it is. If you have nothing to back it, it's just speculation.
Yeah, as Billy Preston said.
Nothing from nothing leaves nothing, right?
Yep.
Well, and I'll say Carmine's presentation is kind of a follow-up to something we started last year and we've done on occasion. We have really tried to focus on this subject as an historical inquiry. And last year we put together a panel on vetting sources and tried to give some guidelines for vetting sources. What we find is there's so many people that are even still entering this subject for the first time, and they're entering it in the world of YouTube and a world that is unfact-checked, largely, like the whole universe has become, and they need some tools. And we did this panel last year, and we picked four or five people, including Rose Jeremy, was one of those that we examined. We presented criteria for vetting sources, and then we deconstructed about five sources, and some of them we said, yeah, they're credible, and some we said they're not credible. So Carmine's carrying on that tradition, and that does get us some flack because we don't treat everything as credible, and that's the way it goes.
I just want to say, and I think that's a wholly common sense approach that is lacking from a lot of these investigations that are in the public and that are popular. But, when it comes down to it, there's really nothing there that makes them credible. So we shouldn't be wasting our time on them. We should only be looking at credible things that have evidence.
Yeah, and sadly, with the proliferation of, things like access to YouTube and all that, it has allowed the resurrection of long, debunked ideas.
Zombie myths.
The zombie myths, right. I mean, literally, that's what they are. Look, I'll give you the low-hanging fruit real quick. I got to tell you guys that at least once a month, I get a question about the limo driver shooting JFK. Just randomly from people that listen or heard a discussion, or how is it you can discount the limo driver? And look, we've been thoroughly through this. They say there's a film of it. They say that, it looks like this. If you look at the blurry old film, guys, every month I get to hear this. And this is one of those things that needs to be put to rest. I'm sorry, but it just does. Anyway. So moving on, though, and believe me, I'm all for the debunking of myths by utilizing things like vetting your evidence properly. And this brings up another subject before we get to one of the elder statesmen, I will say, among researcher authors who is on the list. Before we get to him, though, Larry, there's going to be some panels here. Is there has that been imagined yet, or is that coming later where you're going to design the panels for discussions and bring some of these speakers together? Because it's not going to just all be lectures all weekend, by the way, folks. There's going to be discussions, question and answer periods, things like that. Have they been designed already? Is it ready to be unveiled yet? Or, am I asking ahead of time what?
No, two specifically are in the works at the moment. And there may be a third, but I've got to see how full the schedule is. Certainly we'll have the panel talking about JFK from an historical perspective, as I mentioned. And we'll also have a panel on the document releases. And basically the topic of that panel will be some of the people that, like Newman and Blunt and Morley, who've been looking at them most closely, going into what they find significant and what is still missing. So there will be a document release panel. Those two are for certain. Whether or not we have more kind of is still up in the air as a scheduling question. One of the things we do have, though, Chuck, is, and you mentioned it, and I mentioned it earlier, we do have authors' sessions scheduled outside the conference, so there is time set aside for the attendees to go down the whole row and literally talk to people individually. And that's something that's done in a structured fashion, during set times and in set locations. So you don't have the challenge of necessarily trying to find when somebody's in the bar or talking to them when they're eating and disturbing them. So that answers part of the question of how do you get the personal interaction and make it controllable, you know?
No, that's great. I'm glad you brought that up because I was actually going to ask about that exactly, you know, how that's going to be structured. I think if you have a lot of newcomers, though, and here's my 2 cents, right? Gee, I wonder how Chuck ever gets the guts to bring up his 2 cents. You know, if you got a lot of newcomers that are going to be there really as novices on the subject, what about sort of a panel of diverse people that, you know, again, could be just among the group of individuals who are generally knowledgeable to sort of go through a general Q&A at some point as well? Do you think there might be something like that there?
Oh, I think that's very possible. We have done that before, and we've also done, and it's interesting because that's one approach to it. The other is to do sort of a series of topical roundtables with kind of a specialist in each area and pick the, you know, the 4 or 5 hottest topics that always come up with each conference and say, all right, we have tables set up on those and you can circulate among those. And that's the person that knows most about it. Go harass them. No, not harass.
yeah.
But both are solutions that it really depends on what we can work into the time frame for that. And one of the challenges this year, frankly, is, and we talked about this earlier, is we're trying to work in the mock trial, CAPA's mock trial that's being conducted in Houston, overlaps a bit with the conference. Some of our speakers are going to be there. That's made it a bit more of a scheduling challenge because I have to determine when they're going to show up. So that's why I'm a little tentative. We do like to have a general Q&A panel. I just not sure if it's going to happen this year. Other than outside the bar, that one I'm sure about.
Yeah, well, that's also something that happens, right? and you will get to interact with people if you go and, you know, you're respectful. I'm very sure that just about anybody that, you know, again, if you're respectful about it, that you wanted to approach, you know, is pretty approachable in a general sense. And I'm very sure that this could be extremely educational for those that are, you know, deeply ensconced in the research, as well as those who are, you know, again, the newcomer, the novice, et cetera. Gary Shaw is the next guy on the list. Now, Gary Shaw, to me, here we go. This is one of the, I said elder statesmen. I wasn't kidding, because we're talking about a guy who was authoring books on this a long time ago. You know, what do you, you know, Cover Up is one of the older books that, I think anybody who has had a book collection on the case at some point in time probably had a copy of it. I know I had, 2 different versions of it myself at one point in time. Interesting guy also. And, you know, he has kind of gotten, well, thrown into the YouTube world, because of some of the television appearances he's done over the years, and things like that. I think Geraldo called upon him at one point in time, you know, a lot of the media figures around the 25th anniversary. He was already an old hand at this, like around then, if memory serves me correctly. You know, so Gary Shaw is definitely an earlier generation researcher, Larry, than, well, quite frankly, any of us on this call tonight. You know, what do you think? What do you think I should add to the description there?
Well, I think there are two. One of the hugely valuable things that Gary brings is that Gary is one of the few remaining Dallas researchers. And we're talking about someone who was on location that could go around and interview and talk to people not long after the incident, who could look people up in the telephone directory, develop a relationship with them. We don't have that sort of thing in Dallas anymore. We just literally do not. And certainly many of those people are gone now. So Gary brings that with him. Gary, you could ask Gary about someone that you only read about now, and Gary can say, oh, yeah, I called them and they said, come over and have coffee, and here's what happened. And, you know, it's hard to capture that other than in the individual. Gary's also interesting in that he left this arena. He left it, dropped it, went away, and has only recently come back to it in the last two or three years with some very special focus. One of the focus area focus that he's quite interested in, and I can't predict how much he will say. He's been trying to do some brand new research, which is interesting to find someone leave the field, come back in, and then be eager enough to do something new. He's investigating a lot of the Cuban exile connections in Dallas and their connections elsewhere and in that community, which unfortunately was one of the areas that was totally ignored immediately after the assassination by both the FBI, apparently, and citizen researchers. So that's quite interesting to me. He's trying to dig back into a hole that nobody really paid nearly enough attention to back when.
You know, that's an interesting thing, too. Carmine, you know how we had that discussion not long ago about individuals who are lesser known names who have sort of melted into the pile of information at this point. Gary Shaw might actually be the guy to talk to who might be able to provide you with a lead on some of these individuals who haven't been developed, not even by the FBI, who were part of the local fabric at the time. You know, whether he knew them directly or knew some of their associates or whatever else, Gary Shaw might be a guy to talk to, actually, about some of those figures.
Oh, okay.
And I think important.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that's important. We're coming more and more to realize, and I wish this is one of those holes that I was talking about. There were things going on in Dallas with the FBI and with CI domestic officers that we don't know about and that we may never fully understand, but we're going to appreciate there are questions emerging about now it appears that the Payne's telephone line was actually tapped and recorded in advance of the assassination. There's some indications of that. There's some indications that the CI domestic guys in Dallas were very much more interested in Oswald on an ongoing basis. We're just beginning that's a total hole. We knew nothing about that. And we're just seeing emerging evidence of an operation that was apparently going on. I will tell you, we mentioned having Jim Hosty there before. And Jim was a great guy to talk to. I talked to him at the conference. I talked to his daughter. I talked to him several times. And Jim would tell you many things, including the fact that the FBI was far more turned on to Lee Harvey Oswald than they ever admitted. But what he wouldn't tell you is interesting also. The one thing that he would never respond to him, even when I gave him a document from Secret Service Agent Patterson, he refused to even acknowledge, look at me, or comment on his remarks about Oswald having been in touch and monitored by the FBI counterintelligence group with subversives in the weeks before the assassination. And Hosty, gentleman that he was, just took the letter that I sent him, and we basically, it's kind of like he obviously doesn't want to talk about this, so we won't. Sometimes what they won't talk about is as interesting as what they will.
Well, right. And, you know, for those of you who might not know, James Hosty was the guy who literally, you can say, destroyed evidence, quite undisputedly destroyed evidence at the behest of his superiors regarding Lee Harvey Oswald, and something that may have been tied to the assassination. There's contention over what was contained in that evidence, but he did that. Was also the agent who was supposed to be tracking Oswald before the assassination and all that. Very interesting story there. In case you don't know, that's who we're talking about there. But I say again that some of these earlier people that were working on things that were familiar with a wider array of characters than we even know about today might have some sort of invaluable leads or information. So that was my point about Gary Shaw. And I really do, Carmine, I want you to make a note of that, that some of these people that we sort of have a little bit of a dead end with the documentation on, you might be able to catch a bridge with a guy like Gary Shaw. So I think that might be a conversation you want to make sure you have. And, you know, for anybody else out there, Gary Shaw is an interesting guy. If he's willing to be approached by the public, he is a wealth of knowledge on the case. Long time worker of it, and somebody studied it for many, many years. I'm not sure how long he stepped away, but if he's coming back to do something new, I'm definitely going to, you know, take a pass at it for sure and take a look over it because it's obviously something new that needs to be examined. Anyway, next on the list is Bill Simpich, who is a civil rights attorney who was on the show not long ago. And, you know, we talked about Mexico City with Bill. I'm not sure what his presentation is going to be, but Bill is extremely ethical as somebody who looks at this stuff. I really appreciate it. And even though I disagree with him just a touch, I would say that we are going to get to the bottom of certain things with the work of somebody like Bill Simpich, who has gone way out of his way again, utilizing probably part of his own vocational skills to get at certain information. But certainly he's gone beyond that. What else should I add to the description of Bill Simpich, Carmine?
Well, I believe he's on the Mary Farrell board, isn't he, Larry?
He is, yeah.
Yeah, Bill's on the Mary Farrell board. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, I was just going to say, just for full disclosure, so is Jeff Morley, so is Deborah Conway, and Marie Fonzie, and myself.
Right. But yeah, and he's also very deep into the Cryptonyms project. It was originally through Rex Bradford that I got involved, but then Rex introduced me to Bill, and then, you know, we've talked on the phone, and I've called him back and forth and asked for his opinion on certain things. And it's good to have. I'm glad that, you know, people like Bill and Larry and Dr. Newman are all, you know, part of the Cryptonym project, because it's good to have other eyes double check your work. And I think that it's important that members of the later generations also start to get involved, because we can't expect that Larry and everybody else who got into this before us is going to do this forever. So it's going to be up to some of us to start trying to help pick up some of the burden for all the new files that are coming out.
Right, exactly.
I can tell you one thing. Bill and I will be doing a joint presentation. We're going to try to, using some of the newer releases, we're going to try to clear up some of the rumors, myths, etc., in regard to ZR Rifle, what it really was, how it really started, how it evolved, how William Harvey came into it. It's a mix of James Angleton and William Harvey and Staff B, how it turned into an executive action project targeting Castro, and we're going to not so much debunk anything, try to clarify what we know about that really now, and reveal that it had a lot more, especially through William Harvey, had more life in 1963 than one might have suspected.
That's great. I'll definitely want to catch that one. I think that, and that's why I think that cryptonyms are important. I know there's only probably a handful of us actually focusing on them, but unless we can break all those codes, we're never going to exactly know who is doing what. So once all those can actually be broken, then we actually have, as Rhett calls it, not a viewfinder, but a code ring to basically all the files.
Well, there you go. And the thing is, I like that Larry uses the word clarification, because really when we turn around and we do our best to dispossess people of certain mythologies connected to the case, the truth is it's not about being a contrarian. It's not about shooting down somebody's opinion or any of this other crap. The bottom line is it's actually about clarification. It's about clearing away the debris that that is really obscuring the view of the landscape. Okay. And look, dead branches aren't doing anybody any good unless you're going to take time for them to rot and melt into things and disappear. And there's been a lot of dead ends over the years. Let's be honest. There's been a lot of dead ends to a lot of theoretical conclusions that really just were not sound. And it's a good thing to clarify it by clearing away some of the things that are obstructions, as opposed to, being part of the actual true landscape. Go ahead, Carmine.
No, I definitely agree with that. That's why I've met a lot of people in the research community, but I've always wanted, come back to those I like to associate with, because they have a high standard for evidence. You know, I definitely respect that about you and about Larry and about Bill and about Dr. Newman, about Rex, Alan Dale, Rob Clark, Trish. A lot of our friends out there actually have a respect for the evidence that a lot of people just set aside because they don't, we've all heard the argument, they faked everything. All the original evidence has been tampered with. You can't base, which is just basically you're abrogating all of your responsibility. You're just saying, I'm going to believe what I want to believe no matter what sort of documents fall in my lap. Mm. And that's just no way to get anywhere. It's basically creating more of these myths until we have a hydra that we have to deal with. And then we have to cut off all the heads and cauterize them to stop the myths from going on.
Well, look, if you're Stephen King and you want to write fictional things based on loose events that are associated with this, fine, do it all day.
Okay? Oswald practicing.
Well, why not add a time traveler and whatever exactly. Else? The Twilight Zone did it before Stephen King. But look, fact is that if you want to get into fiction, that's, I guess, an admirable profession for some people. But if you want to get into historical reality, there's a different methodology here. And, it may vary a little bit between us, but there should be a general respect for getting at something that's verifiable, that is, a workable thesis, at least to begin with. Let's be reasonable and let's get something done here. I'd like to see this thing put to rest, honestly, Larry, no offense, so that there's no need for a Lancer conference any longer, because we don't have to come together. We actually know what happened, how it went down, and that's the end of it. Here it is. I would love to get there before I shuffle loose this mortal coil. But, we're not going to get there by deceiving ourselves long before we, ever get to presenting something in general that that reaches, the level of being able to explain these events in full. Okay. So, and I'm not even saying that we're going to answer every single question, every single position of minutia, but I think that there is a reasonable chance that we can give people a reasonable understanding of what actually occurred here, if all of us are not wasting our time on a lot of pointless diversions. I'm sorry to say, but that's really what it comes down to.
Can I? I just wanted to say one more thing.
Sure.
I wanted to say that, and I think it also is because, people like Larry and Chuck and myself, it's not just respect for the evidence. It's also respect for the public. We don't want to add to the mess that has been left behind. We want to clear the table so we can actually, as Chuck said, reveal the true landscape beneath. Because, and it's not just people who support a conspiracy. There are a lot of great, well-informed, evidence-using conspiracy advocates out there. But there's officials out there that are pushing myths, too. You know, just this week I've seen in alternative media and on some of the social media, someone bandying about that Oswald said, threatened at the Cuban embassy, he was going to kill Kennedy. That doesn't exist. That's not in any of the documents, because I asked for the document, and of course they couldn't produce it. So both sides are spewing myths, you know, whenever it serves their agendas. And if we're going to get to the truth, we have to knock down all of those myths from both sides.
Well, no, absolutely. And with that, before we get into the final thoughts on this discussion tonight, the last person on the list, only because it is in alphabetical order, is Stu Wexler. Now, this is a guy, of course, none of us have ever heard of, so no idea what to say about Stu Wexler. Here I am with the jokes again. Okay, let's get serious. Stu, obviously, if you've been a longtime listener of this show, you might know that he co-authored a book with Larry called The Awful Grace of God, which is about the King assassination. But Stu has done a lot of work on the Kennedy assassination, some of it actually involving, you know, the statistical analysis of certain things. Stu's done a lot of different work, actually, and not received a level of credit that I think he deserves. Also, I'm interested in getting him on here again very soon about some of the other projects he's interested in and working on. But Larry, is there some way you could provide us with a hint of what it is Stu Wexler is going to discuss at the conference?
About as close as I can get, and this is kind of like Mr. Robertson. Stu's primary focus for some time has been primary source interviews. And he has been pursuing, he does something like Gary Muir does, only Stu does it with people that you don't think about talking to necessarily. And Stu's pursuing a couple of leads that, If I name them before he starts talking about them, might not do his presentation any good. So I don't want to be mysterious, but I've got to let him finish what he's doing. he will be talking about, he will, if Carmine's debunking myths and leads, Stu will be opening up new ones that we just haven't looked at before.
Which
and I
is,
think Carmine, you saw that last year. He did the same thing last year. He tends to dissect things and come up with names that everybody else disregarded and then investigate them.
Which is also extremely valuable, because a lot of the things that have been exhausted over the years have been fruitless. You know, so new avenues of investigation might be necessary to complete the portrait. You know what? I said the word might. They are necessary. Okay, because as far as I'm concerned, you're not going to come up with a solution where you have Lee Harvey Oswald alone. As far as I'm concerned, you're not going to come up with this mad, crazy conspiracy where you have, you know, 50 people, 8 teams, you know, 16 walkie-talkies, I don't know how many rifles, and, you know, and also an abort team. No. Listen, we got to get down to some realistic things, and it's probably and very likely in the realm of that which has yet to be examined. So, you know, and I love the work that that Stu did on, you know, bullets some years ago. This is what introduced me to him in the first place, not directly and personally, but this is what made me stand up and take notice of what it was he was doing. Because, again, this is a guy who, you know, he's working in Jersey, by the way. So I got a little bit of a warmth for him there, you know, who took the time to break down a very complex analysis that someone who, you know, is supposed to have a bona fide, oh, well, let's just say, reputation in a particular field, who a lot of people were listening to, Stu absolutely devastated this conclusion that, and you know who I'm talking about, don't you, Larry?
yes. I think it's called in general terms, neutron activation analysis, but I won't name any actual names.
Yeah, there you go. The NAA studies, and basically, you know, to put it in a nutshell, and I advise people to go look at this work for themselves. Stu showed that, you know, the bullet lead analysis that people were utilizing and trying to use a magician's trick, if you will, to keep people distracted. Look, I have all this information. I understand how all this stuff breaks down. It all comes down to a bunch of bull is what happens when you actually look at the real situation. I loved it when I think I saw Stu present this in 2003. Pretty sure it was at the WEC conference, actually, in Pittsburgh, where I think he talked about this. I my memory is a little bit foggy on it, but it was just one of those aha moments where I really said to myself, you know, damn, this guy's good. I'm sorry, but Stu Wexler is an incredible individual and extremely, extremely ethical once again in his research. You know, you said it's kind of obsessive. I don't know if obsessive is the right word. I think meticulous is the word I would use. But then again, I may be wrong. He might be obsessive about it as well. But meticulous is certainly an apt title for what it is Stu does with every subject he approaches, in my estimation. So
I would suggest clinical also. And just to give a feel for it, Stu is the kind of guy who will call me up and say, what do you think of so-and-so? And I'll go, huh? Like, okay, I never even heard of this. I never paid any attention to it. And he will say, well, I just talked to their father, uncle, aunt, and cousin, and here's what they have to say. And I'll just put my head on the table and go, okay, whatever. I surrender.
Yeah, well, I love that because, again, you know, he's going to areas. See, that's the thing. That's what I keep hearing about a lot of these speakers. You got people going to areas that have not been gone to before. You got people putting aside and removing the need for distraction. It sounds to me like the Lancer conference this year in 2017 is going to be extremely productive. And I'm really happy to be a part of it and really feel kind of out of place. but I'm going to do my best not to let Larry down for sure, because I'm pretty sure I'm one of those wild cards
He was
allowed to select.
It's okay, Chuck. There'll be at least one other weirdo there.
Yeah, well, look, the two Italians anyways, you know, we got to walk in together, okay? Sorry, I had to go there. All right, I appreciate that and always appreciate your guidance. And of course, you know, Deborah Conway is the name that we have brought up. And I would love to talk to Deborah about this. Anybody else who's on the list here, in fact, who wants to come on this show and discuss what it is they're going to talk about or their latest work, you know, I'm certainly into this idea. I'm very excited about it. And I hope that those of you who are listening, who care about this topic, also realize that that I think this one is going to be quite a bit different from a lot of other years. I think it's going to be more productive. No offense to the other 15 years you put in or anything, Larry, but I feel really good about the general grouping of people here and the work and the attitude that is beginning to emerge. So extremely happy to be a part of it. And with that, because we are down to the last couple of minutes here, I feel as though I should surrender the floor to Larry. And, you know, what is it that we should take away from this entire discussion, Larry?
I think one of the things, and to summarize it, these should get better because we know more. What really, we build up a body of knowledge. We build up a body of facts. We know what is true and provable and can be corroborated versus what isn't. We understand the crypts. We can read the documents. We can read the routing in the documents. It's kind of like Gary Shaw coming back into this, and you brought this up. You could probably go to Gary and ask him about people that we're interested in that nobody even considered then. We know now what, if we had known in 1964, 1965, could have solved the case. Our only problem is that we're displaced in time, so we have to work a lot harder at it. It took us 50 plus years to learn what we really needed to know because of the extent to which the Warren Commission obfuscated the whole matter. And now we should be getting better.
Well, absolutely. And once again, the Lancer Conference will run from November 17th to the 19th this year, and it'll be at the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas, Texas. You can go to jfklancer.com and find your way with a link. I think it's Dallas 2017 or something like that. But there's an easily clickable link there to get to the site and the speakers. And I will also include it as a link in this podcast tonight. So once again, a special thanks to Carmine Sabastano, my Thursday co-host, and Larry Hancock, who will be back with us tomorrow night to discuss a slightly different topic. Anyway, the Ocelli Effect is done for tonight. I hope that you guys have learned something and heard something, and maybe you'll get as excited to get to a conclusion about this particular historical narrative as I am. Anyway, if you're not, sorry if I bored you, but I'm not bored. Anyway, you guys have a good night and be well no matter who you are, where you are. If you're listening to this show, I certainly wish you well.